As a thankful recipient of many, many skincare products over the years, I've learned to discern what is naturally actually activating my skin to rebalance and recalibrate on its own. That's what your skin is meant to be doing, and it keeps getting disrupted by all these choices that we make. So, when the founder and creator of Herbal Face Food reached out to me, I was all ears. I didn't know why at first. It turns out that Herbal Face Food is the most potent antioxidant skincare line on the market today, period. The raw plant ingredients in each of their products are never processed, never manipulated with synthetics or emulsifiers. These anti-aging botanicals are combined with the most precious plant concentrates, and they have changed my skin. Here's how. I'm going to talk about two of the products, the Herbal Face Food serums and the cream. The serums contain powerful phytoenzymes and antioxidants. These are activated and infused into your tissues. They hydrate and increase the resiliency of your skin, and they feel like they're plumping up your face. I use serum 1 daily. I use serum 2 when I'm tired and I need extra firming for my skin. And I use the X, which is also known as the cure, for a small patch of rosacea that flares up every now and again, which you cannot see because of these products. When you feed your skin with Herbal Face Food, you will feel real live ingredients at work. An activating flush, an invigorating tingle, some warmth, all of these are evidence of your skin healing at the cellular level and years of damage reversing. The cream is the most potent moisturizer I've ever tried, and I've tried them all. I live in the high desert. This cream contains 102 of the world's most powerful anti-aging botanicals and is also the world's first and only edible SPF with a protection rating of SPF 50+. And this is accomplished 100% by plant power. And you can expect intense hydration, soothing for your tired skin. You can expect to see inflammation calmed and rebuilding of elasticity, so your complexion looks and feels more smooth and more radiant. Herbal Face Food is not plant-based. It's plant-powered. It has the highest rating on the ORAC anti-aging scale. ORAC means oxygen radical absorbance capacity. I never knew what that meant before. The highest, over 30 million on that scale. By contrast, vitamin C in skincare rates under 100,000. Herbal Face Food is using all post-consumer recycled materials and packaging. They use glass and aluminum, which is super easy to recycle as well. The products and packaging are 99% free of plastics. They contain no ingredients that involve the destruction or harm of any plant, animal, or marine life. These are 100% plants only, these products. These active concentrates are coming from the seeds, the fruits, the leaves, or the flowers of the plants only. These products have been a complete revolution for me. I know that you will love the way your skin looks and feels after using it even for just a day or two. And the best part is that Herbal Face Food has offered us, you, my community, a code to receive 20% off forever, ever. The code is capital ELENA 20. Once again, that's my name in all caps, Elena 2020. The site is herbalfacefood.com. The code is all caps Elena 20. It's not just your first purchase, it's any purchase. You will love these products, and I am so grateful, Herbal Face Food, for the change that you have made in my life. Thank you. Welcome to the Practice You podcast. My name is Elena Brower. Let's dive into today's conversation regarding life's myriad transitions and how we refine our responses in our relationships, our wellness, our households, our work, and in our practices. You are invited to learn and love and listen with me. Welcome to Practice You. Welcome back to the podcast. I have a new friend today. This is a fellow author at Shambhala. She is a clinical psychologist specializing in treating relationships. She's a co-host for the Psychologists Off the Clock podcast. She's an assistant professor at Brown University. She's also a parent of three. Yael Schoenbrunn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on your wonderful podcast. I'm honored to have the chance to speak with you today.
Thank you so much. Your book is called Work, Parent, Thrive. The subtitle for this book, our listener, is 12 Science-Backed Strategies to Ditch Guilt, Manage Overwhelm, and Grow Connection When Everything Feels Like Too Much. And I think there is no more important conversation. I want to give our listener the visual. On the cover of the book, we have a little seesaw of sorts with a clock on one side and a mug on the other. And the seesaw is actually having the same color as the word thrive. The mug is having the same color as the word parent. The clock, of course, is having the same color as the word work. So this was a very well thought out art and design endeavor. So I just want to shout out whoever was responsible for that at Shambhala. Well done. Work, Parent, Thrive is a real study of, and it has been for me. I wish I was a little younger reading it. But the Working Parent Act has 6 core processes. I want to start there in the introduction. ACT, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. Okay, you with me, our listener? Acceptance and Commitment Therapy has 6 core processes that are important in helping people to live more satisfying lives, even when realities are uncomfortable or downright objectionable, as you say in the book. We're on page 20 of the introduction, Roman numeral XX. Getting in touch with the present moment is number 1. Accepting with equanimity the thoughts, emotions, and experiences with which you struggle is number 2. 3 is becoming aware of your thoughts and your stories. This is a big one. We're going to get into stories today. 4, learning to unhook from unhelpful thoughts and stories when you get caught up in them. 5, knowing what you want to stand for in this moment. And 6, taking committed action to move your life in directions that matter to you. Here's what's cool. These 6 core processes are the fundament of psychological flexibility. Awesome. This is not just for parents. So if you're listening and you're like, well, I don't have kids, maybe this isn't for me, I dare you to stay with us, because I dare say this is definitely for all of us. I was just speaking with an old friend this weekend who's the parent of 2 grown boys. She shall remain unnamed. But she has a story in her head about this partnership that has nothing to do with reality. And is in fact something else entirely other than what she's sort of accusing the world of doing to her. So these 6 core processes are critical. Yael, how did you go from sort of ascertaining these processes and mapping them onto parenting?
Well, it's sort of all the different parts of my life converged when I became a working parent. When I became a mother, I was working as a researcher at Brown University, where I'm still housed. And I have long been fascinated by relationships. So my bread and butter is relationship research. And I'm also very consumed by positive psychology, so the study of happiness. And it had never occurred to me before I became a working parent that our roles exist in relationship with one another. But when I found myself really unhappy, the opposite of what positive psychology was trying to get me to do, I got really curious about what realistic and feasible and enjoyable path forward might be. And because I also am a clinical psychologist who maintains a small private practice, I'm also very familiar with a lot of these evidence-based treatments, one of which, as you just described, is acceptance and commitment therapy. So I kind of pulled together this idea that our roles are in relationship with one another, that there are ways that social science can help us to be happier, and that there are clinical practices that in a sort of moment-to-moment, day-to-day way can help us to find a better path forward. And so for me, as somebody who loves science and who is really engaged with clinical practice, I sort of use acceptance and commitment therapy as the framework, and throughout the book, pull from different pockets of social science to explain sort of why these practices are so powerful.
Got it. I want to move us through a lot of this book for our listeners' sake today. My thought is to move directly into the mindset shift on page 28. The reason being is it's kind of the first frontier. Is that okay with you? Or do you feel like I'm skipping too far ahead?
No. At the end of the day, when people read the book, my greatest hope is that people experience a mindset shift. So that's a perfect place to start and end.
Okay, amazing. Amazing. Here's the deal. We're on page 28, our listener. Examples of common mindsets include personality is fixed versus personality is malleable. So when you hear somebody say, for example, well, I was born like that, I'm just like that, you know, wow, that is completely a fixed mindset, whereas malleable, or as Carol Dweck calls it, the growth mindset, she's a pioneering Stanford psychologist, it's a much different way of seeing the world. So that's the first. Second example of a common mindset, effortful activities deplete my energy versus effort is invigorating. That goes right into things like adversity mimetics when it comes to your body. When you put yourself in cold water, you do work out until you're, you know, exhausted, panting. These are really things that may seem to deplete your energy in the short term, but in the long run are actually wonderful for your telomeres and your health, your longevity. Third mindset example, happiness is genetically determined versus happiness can be intentionally grown or expanded. You see where we're going, our listener. Last common mindset example is work and parenthood are in conflict versus work and parenting can actually enrich each other. So let's talk about that last one. Our listener kind of knows enough to know these first three are definitely a choice that we make. And I will encourage you time and time again with every single guest that I have to opt for the growth mindset, opt for the malleability, the volatility of your mindset. It's always changeable. But this shifting from work and parenthood in conflict to work and parenthood supporting each other is very important. I would like to hear your personal example, Yael, if you have one, of how you came to understand this. And then I think I might have one of my own.
Oh, I love the personal examples. And you do such a great job of describing the fixed mindset idea versus growth mindset idea. And I just want to pause there for a second, because I think so many people are familiar with this idea that a growth mindset is so much more powerful and effective in our lives. But it's amazing how many areas that we can have a growth mindset where we just tend to assume things are fixed. And work, family, conflict is one of these areas. Our public conversation is so much focused on the conflict between roles, which is true. Just as, you know, somebody who struggles in math, like it may be true that their natural inclination isn't to find math appealing or easy, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a place to go, a place to progress to that is available to them. And the same thing goes in the relationship between our roles, that there is conflict. I'm not arguing that. I don't think anybody who is a working parent could deny that there is definitely conflict between roles. But what I think is really important to recognize is that the relationship between our roles is so much more complex and interesting. And there's a lot of richness to be had if we can open our minds up to see where there can be enrichment, where the roles can help each other out. My favorite example is the idea of rest. So we often think about rest as being on a beach, you know, with a Mai Tai, you know, sitting on the sand and just kind of relaxing or taking a nap. But what research shows is that when we step from one role into another, even if the other role that we're stepping into is quite demanding, that we get a rest from the role that we're stepping away from. And if you're a working parent, or if you're just an adult who has multiple demanding roles, you can think about sort of the moment that you step from one role. In my case, you know, when I drop my kids off at their camps or school and I go to work, I have a chance to rest the parenting part of myself. Even though I'm going in to work with clients or to do writing or to deal with insurance companies, as I do for my professional world. And then at the end of a long, exhausting workday, I have a chance, and in fact, I have some pressure to put away my work and go see my kids. And I've had such a long day without them that I'm feeling excited and energized to go see them. And that is real evidence that of this effect of resting because I've stepped away from one demanding role. And so for me, this is a really sort of overlooked example of the way that our roles can help each other out and help us access things that we don't even realize we're able to access. And the more that we recognize it, the more we can amplify that experience. So recognizing that I'm resting my parenting self helps me to savor that experience a bit more. Mm.
You know, I really appreciate that, actually. It's not dissimilar to my own experience, stepping away and then stepping back in. I want to honor the fact that there are many parents that don't have that latitude. So to the single parents who are kind of in it all the time, all the time, all the time, and it really does feel like work is not helpful, how can we help that person?
I think that's such a great question. And in fact, I think it's one of the advantages of working parenthood is that you have this structure around getting breaks from each role. Mm-hmm. And what I tell folks who are either stay-at-home parents or single parents is that it's really important to engage a support network so that you can step out of parenting role, because there is probably no role in life that is as depleting as parenting. And it's because we care so much and because our kids need so much from us. And we have this ethos in our culture that good parents are kind of on all the time and available all the time. And it's a real mistake, and science really bears this out, that in order to be a good parent, the answer isn't to always be available and around. In order to be a good parent, we need to take breaks. And if you are in a position where those breaks are not naturally structured, it is really helpful to recognize that it benefits you and your child or children to build in those breaks. And one of the things that we can do in order to build those breaks is build out a support network, you know, either of neighbors who you can take turns with or daycare providers who you rely on, and to give yourself not only permission, but encouragement to lean on those networks in the service of your child. Again, because it gives you an opportunity to recharge your battery and to come back, and reduces your risk for burnout, which of course is very important for child outcomes.
Right. Thank you for that. That's very helpful. For me, work, parenting, there was a period of time when my son was much younger and I was traveling a great deal. And it sucked, actually. He and I both felt the missing sort of time. We had a wonderful sitter and she's still a part of our family. And, you know, we were very lucky in many regards. But when we would come back together, the feeling of elation and contentment and the snuggles, oh my God, that we used to have when he was so much younger, were epic. To your point, stepping away and coming back, I mean, was really a gift from God. It felt like, okay, if I have to go away, this coming back business is my favorite business. Oh, it's just such a joy.
I love that example. And I think embedded in there are probably even more enrichment opportunities that you could identify. And one example that I like to think about is, you know, we often feel really guilty or just sad because we miss our kids when we step away. And the missing in and of itself is very painful. And we can kind of soothe ourselves by, as you're noting, the magical opportunity to come back and reconnect and the joy that we have. In addition, there's also these really cool opportunities for your children, your child, to connect to other caregivers, which is actually quite good for them, and to develop independence, resilience, creative problem solving, because you're not there to swoop in and help them out. I remember one time last year when my kindergartner had a field trip that landed on a day where I see patients, and so I couldn't go. And I remember feeling so bummed and sad for him and sad for me that I couldn't be there for him. And at the end of the day, what he told me is, they went on an apple picking field trip, and he asked one of the other chaperones, he was so proud of himself that he asked one of the other chaperones to help him get an apple that was really high up. And he was so proud of himself for being assertive and getting his needs met and speaking up and connecting to that caregiver who was a stranger before that day. And so I think it's easy to sort of feel guilty and to focus on the missing. And one of the things that we can really offer ourselves is this opportunity, just as you described, of looking at what the embedded gifts might be without undermining the fact that we do miss our kids and we do wish we could have more connection or whatever the things are that we're yearning for.
Thank you, Element, for sponsoring the Practice You podcast. We have been personally using Element for well over a year. Element is spelled L-M-N-T. Elemental electrolyte salts that have completely changed the game around my house. Every night before bed, James and I split a packet. Helps us sleep, helps us get good solid rest, and helps combat fatigue, muscle pain, fogginess, irritability even. Did you know that your cells need electrolytes for optimal function? And if you're struggling with any of those things, you might just be deficient in electrolytes. They facilitate hundreds of cellular functions in your body, including nerves, hormone regulation, nutrient absorption, fluid balance. Element contains 1,000 milligrams of sodium, 200 milligrams of potassium, and 60 milligrams of magnesium. No artificial anything in here, no sugar, no nothing. My favorite flavors, as I said, orange, watermelon, and the chocolate caramel in hot water is just incredible. Element comes in tiny single-serving packets you can carry with you wherever you go. They're great on planes as well. With my link, you get a free sample pack with any order so that you can try all the flavors. And that link is drinkelement.com/Elena. The spelling is drinkelement.com/Elena. Thank you. Thank you so much again, Element. Again, the link, drinkelement.com/Elena.
Right.
You know, we go from here to the concept of all the unhelpful labels that we put on ourselves, our parenting, our experience. These are all sort of labels that are stuck in time. It's like they're in some sort of time capsule, and they still live on in our brains from our childhood, hearing our parents say them. All of the guilt, the overwhelm, even rage in parenthood, you posit, are opportunities to practice unhooking from rigid and unhelpful labels. There's a three-step approach that you offer in your book on page 57. Step one being noticing the common labels. Notice how you label your most uncomfortable working parent experiences. What are some of the words that float through your mind as you experience or reflect on working parenthood in general? The second step would be to create distance between you and that label, describing the words as labels, as thoughts, as descriptions. I'm labeling myself, I'm labeling my child, I'm labeling my working parenthood. You know, I'm having the thought, rather than saying this is true, you sort of contextualize what you're about to spit out or what you're about to spin around in your brain into, this is actually just a label. This is just a concept. It's not actually what's happening. Thirdly, you sort of turn your attention away from that unhelpful label and you turn towards some other alternative as you go on to say on page 58, modifying I can't to phrases like I haven't yet figured out how to do that or I'm still learning how to do that. I use that so many times when I was a parent with my kid and he would say, Mom, you know, whatever, I need this or this needs to happen. And I truly have no idea how to make this happen. And I have to say to him, I can't figure this one out right now. I haven't yet figured this out. Instead of saying, oh, this is impossible or, you know, whatever the wall is that I'm about to put up, I change it into, I'm actually right here learning along with you. And there isn't a manual.
You're right.
Some people say that that's not a good idea, but I think my son, now that he's almost 17, I think he really appreciated the times when I was like, you know, I have actually no idea how to do this. And instead of saying I do and making you smaller and me bigger, mm-hmm. I'm going to say, I'm still learning. I have no clue what the right answer is here. Let's figure it out together.
Yeah, it normalizes the experience of not knowing and sets our children up for a life of being okay with not knowing and being willing to set themselves on a course to finding out more. I mean, and Carol Dweck talks about this in her writing, that yet is a very powerful word for growth mindset. That when we say, I haven't figured it out yet, it leaves open the possibility that we could, and that that possibility is really contingent on our willingness to try, the resources that we draw on, our ability to pull from those resources, our willingness to practice, and to keep trying until we do. And in fact, the more we set ourselves up to try more, to seek out resources and to practice, the more likely it is that we will figure it out. And so I think, and as you did for your son, we want to normalize that process, that there isn't some sort of end game where an adult is just all knowing and has all the answers. In fact, that's part of a life of learning and a life of growing.
Hmm. Which leads really well into the concept of the stories that we tell ourselves about what's possible and what's happening. On page 66, you talk about a few sort of questions to guide our reflections as parents or as people. What are my feelings telling me about how I'm experiencing this event? Can I learn more about what's important to me right now? What have I learned about my triggers that can be helpful for managing myself or my situation better in the future? And finally, how do I want to integrate this information into how I understand myself? So this is pretty cool. I mean, these are questions that we forget to ask ourselves all the time. And when we forget to ask ourselves these questions, what ends up happening is we say, well, my kid is just like that, and I'm just like this. It's never going to work.
Yeah.
Or, you know, this situation is intractable, untenable, and I don't know how to fix it, and I'll never know. Which is pretty, you get stuck in a pattern like that, and there's no getting out of that. Whereas what you're about to say, I'm sure, is if we just unhook from these stories, everything can change.
That's right. And that doesn't mean that a crummy situation is all of a sudden, you know, roses and sunshine. I'm not trying to convey, you know, a toxic positivity message or Pollyanna message. There's this great quote from Julia Child that I love, and it goes as follows. You can't turn a sow's ear into a veal Orloff, but you can do something very good with a sow's ear. And what I take that to mean is that there are challenges in life, but depending on how we construct the story, we can set ourselves on a course to feel pretty stuck, or we can set ourselves on a course to sort of figure out a better path forward for us, given what is true. And so it is a little bit like the Serenity Prayer. Like, it helps us accept what can't be changed and change what can and find the silver linings in what's difficult. And that is the power of a story, right? It doesn't change reality, but it can, in a very profound way, help us manage what is hard and create a path and a life for ourselves that is more workable. And I think, you know, it's important to recognize that we're not just characters in the stories that we're living, we're also the narrators. And so we do have a lot of power in editing our stories. And a lot of what acceptance and commitment therapy teaches is how to do that skillfully. And, you know, it's not about detaching from reality, because, you know, sometimes truth just is what it is, but it's about figuring out what to pay attention to and how to sort of direct, you know, what we highlight and what we do with what we highlight, if that makes sense.
It definitely does. Skipping ahead to page 139, where you invite us as parents, and I want to say, I think this is as people, to reflect on how whatever seems to be keeping you from the thing that you want to be doing. So if it's work, parenting, the work is keeping you from being more present as a parent. If it's, you know, your day job and your passion project, the day job is keeping you from the passion project. Think about this. The job is requiring you to get skilled in some arena, whatever it is. It's counting out change for a cup of coffee. It's making, I don't know, education. It's administration, service, manufacturing, whatever it is. Can you find a way to reflect on how those skills are actually helping you in the other realm, whether it's your passion or your parenting? Because I think that what you're pointing us all toward, whether we're parents or not, is yes, it's not a Pollyanna, it's not some sort of toxic positivity, but it is a way to look at what's happening, at the reality of what's happening, and find rivulets of truth and beauty.
Yeah, that's right, 100%. And it goes to, you know, it's not either or thinking, it's both and. We can recognize that it is hard to be kept from what we're doing, like as you were describing, you know, when you were traveling a lot and missing your son so much. That is true. And it was a beautiful thing to come home and embrace one another after having that pain of missing one another. And you wouldn't have had that beautiful reuniting if you hadn't had the chance to miss each other. Both are true. And the sort of science of what you're speaking to is what I call creative constraints. And it's these ways that we often think about constraints as being problematic and something to overcome. And it's really a different framing of constraints. It's being willing to look at not being available for your kid because you have to go to work as an opportunity to build skill that can then transfer back into your parenting role. And the same thing goes, you know, when you have to leave work because you're right in the middle of getting something done, you know, can you see that as an opportunity to take a break from cognitively taxing tasks and to use that time to incubate on the problems that you're stuck on and to come back refreshed the following day? So it doesn't mean that it's not frustrating. It doesn't mean that you don't wish that you had some more support and somebody else that could do that pickup that day. But given what is, can you find the benefit? I talk about these three pathways of how work and parenting, or really any two demanding roles, can help each other out. One of the paths that you're pointing to is what I call the transfer effect. And that's the idea that when we're stepping into one role, we're often building skills that can come back to the role that we're stepping at in really cool, creative ways. The second path, and I'll just mention these quickly, is the buffer effect. And that's when we're really having a hard time. Like if your kid is going through a tough developmental milestone, going to work can provide a little bit of a stress buffer because it kind of expands your perspective or offers you an opportunity to have a positive experience in a day that it would otherwise be pretty tough. And then the third is the additive effect. And that's the idea that happy, fulfilled lives are usually full of meaning and purpose. And when we have more roles, it is both true that that is more stressful and overwhelming, and that it's an opportunity to have more places where we can derive a sense of meaning and purpose.
Right. Thank you so much for that. I want to skip to the finesse your stress chapter, which I think is really important for all of us, regardless of whether we're parents or not. And really, you know, regardless of mindset, there's so much harsh evaluation that we put on ourselves that really cause more stress than the actual reality itself. And I would love to hear you talk a little bit about that, because as you say on page 215, a mindset that assumes stress to be problematic and unbearable overlooks many of stress's benefits.
That's right.
Right? It can aggravate the negative impacts of stress and interfere with the positive ones. Yes, stress can be uncomfortable, even deeply painful, but it's also unavoidable. And the belief that stress is bad for us is actually what puts the nail in the coffin. One study attempting to disentangle the effects of stressors and beliefs about how stress affects health found that neither stressful events nor stress as debilitating mindset was independently associated with premature death. In fact, people who experienced high levels of stress but didn't view stress as harmful had a lower risk of death, lower than even those with low stress. So interesting.
It's fascinating. Yeah, this science is really so compelling for me. And if listeners are interested, there's a terrific book by Kelly McGonigal that dives deeply into this research called The Upside of Stress. It's a fun read, actually. But the idea, and you're speaking to this, is that stress is actually wired into us for a very adaptive purpose. The stress response is really defined by when we have demands on us that we don't have the resources to meet. And the physiological and neurological response that we have when we're stressed out is what helps us to meet demands that we don't innately have the resources to meet. So it both, you know, kind of activates us, gets us our adrenaline going, and or helps us reach out to other resources to help us to meet those demands. But the problem is, in our modern culture, we've begun to define stress as something that's bad. And what's so important to recognize is that when we construct an understanding of our stress response in this way, it actually makes the stress much harder to tolerate and much less helpful to us. Whereas if we see stress as something that's helpful to us, it actually helps us to meet the demands more effectively, more skillfully, more enjoyably even. And I think the research on this is just so compelling that we really should begin to think of stress as something that is enhancing. And that doesn't mean that it's comfortable. And it also doesn't mean that all stressors are good. Again, I don't want to sort of drop into this extreme kind of thinking, because, you know, if you're really in danger, if you are in a perennial, you know, chronically stressful situation, that actually isn't very good. But, you know, there's this fairly large gray zone of stressful experiences where we actually can use that stress in quite beneficial, positive ways.
Right. All of this is so important for us to remember. It's so painfully easy to forget. And I think our assumption about stress being a problem and we have to eliminate it at all costs is actually not the game. To me, in my understanding now, the game is actually finding ways to be with reality as it is, with equanimity, as you say at the very beginning of the book, using the acceptance and commitment model to just forge a relationship with ourselves that is supportive when things go sideways.
I love that.
And for that, I really thank you. Yeah, I really thank you for this book. Talk to our listener a little bit about anything that we might have missed here in this conversation, or anything that you feel is really important for a parent or for a human who is managing some sort of, you know, inevitable difficulty at this time.
Well, we didn't have a chance to talk about self-compassion, which I think is a really important psychological construct with a lot of evidence behind it. And I think, you know, life is hard if you have multiple demanding roles and are going through a difficult patch of life. It is really challenging. And what we understand from science on self-compassion is that it can be really tempting to be hard on ourselves or just to get angry with the world. And it makes sense that that is the response. But ultimately, what tends to be more helpful in boosting our resilience, in enabling us to meet the demands that are before us, is engaging practices of self-compassion. And self-compassion is defined by researchers as having three distinct components. So one is mindfulness, so making contact in the present moment without judgment with what's difficult. The second component is self-kindness, right? Oftentimes we talk to ourselves in such dismissive or critical ways, in ways that we would never talk to somebody else that we loved. And so the practice there is to literally practice talking to yourself the way that you would somebody that you care deeply about, like a dear friend or even your child. You know, what would you say to them if they were having a hard time? And the third component is practicing common humanity. And that's the idea of recognizing that even though when we're having a hard time, it feels like we're the only person that feels that way and we're really alone in it, to remember that most of the time it's just a real human experience. There might be unique aspects to what you're going through, but we all go through hard times. We all doubt ourselves. We all feel inadequate. We all drop the ball. We all feel hurt and lonely. And so to remember that that is just human and that you're in good company is so comforting and healing. And so, you know, if you're going through something difficult, I think, you know, for me, self-compassion is such a touchstone to recenter myself and to find, you know, my balance.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's something that I'm learning in nonviolent communication too, with Judith Lassiter, a couple of other great teachers. But to have that space, I was just writing about this, sitting with my kid in a car. He was many years ago, probably 4 or 5 years ago, and he would, you know, have all of his moods as a 13, 14-year-old person. And instead of taking them personally, after I started learning MVC, I started actually, like, just being there for myself and knowing that he was going through his own experience and it probably had nothing to do with me. Taking my ego out of it and just giving myself some care, some compassion, like you said.
Yeah.
Made all the difference.
Like, it does.
Big, big difference.
Yeah. What I think is so profound about that is that it doesn't change anything, right? He's still going through what he's going through and you're still going through what you're going through, but it just changes the entire experience of how you go through it. It doesn't feel so scary. It doesn't feel so damning. It just, you know, sort of softens the path.
Yep. So grateful. Can I call you doctor? Or are you like Yael better?
You can just call me Yael, if you don't mind.
I don't mind. I want to thank you so much for all the hard work and the studentship that you have put into this wonderful book. I do think that it's relevant to all of us, not just parents, but it's wonderful for parents. And just thank you for being so thorough and direct and also soft and caring in your writing. This is not a book where you're just going to get told what to do and left on the curb. It's a book that really holds your hand through learning how to see things in a different way, through a different lens. And I really appreciated every bit of it. So thank you for that.
Oh, well, thank you. Those compliments mean the world to me, especially coming from an author I admire as much as you. And I just have to say, you have like the most beautiful voice to listen to. It sort of puts me right at ease. So your podcast is wonderful and your listeners are lucky to have you leading guiding them.
Thank you so much. I want to repeat for our listener today, Yael Schoenbrunn is also the co-host for Psychologists Off the Clock podcast. And where can we find your work, Yael?
You can find me on social media at Yael Schoenbrunn, and you can also check out my writing at workparentthrive.com. And then I also recently launched a newsletter that's all about the science of relationships, including the relationship between roles, but also the relationship between parents and children and between romantic partners and friendship. So you can check that out through my website, and it is called Relational.
Thank you so much for being here today. And really a treat to meet you. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
You as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, AG1, for sponsoring the Practice You podcast. My listener, you've been hearing me talk about AG1 for some time. I think I've been taking it daily for almost 3 years. 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food-sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens in one scoop in the morning. The best way to start your day. Supports your gut health, your nervous system, your immune system, your energy, recovery, focus, and longevity, the conversation of the moment. The taste is delicious. It's suitable whether you eat keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free. It contains less than 1 gram of sugar. No nonsense in here at all. It's a multivitamin that your body will actually absorb. If you are wanting to make an investment in your health and longevity, AG1 costs you less than $3 a day, far less expensive, and definitely less time-consuming than many different supplements. Reclaim your health, arm your immune system with convenient, delicious daily nutrition. And since you listen to the Practice You podcast, Athletic Greens is giving you a free 1-year supply of immune-boosting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is go to athleticgreens.com/Elena. Once again, that's athleticgreens.com/ELENA. Take ownership of your health, my listener. And thank you, Athletic Greens and AG1.